Hey folks, if you haven't tried Audible yet, what are you waiting on? You've heard me talk about it for a while now. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers to mysteries and thrillers, true crime and more. Audible is the home of storytelling. You'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive new series. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. But members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts, and you can download or stream those included titles all you want. And the Audible app is great. Makes it very easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, walking the dog, or just doing your chores. Right now, I'm listening to a thriller titled Then She Was Gone by Lisa Jewell. It's absolutely amazing. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/TCAT or text TCAT to 500-500. That's audible.com/TCATT or text TCAT to 500-500. Everyone, and welcome to episode 228 of the True Crime All the Time podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me as always is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, what is going on?
Hey man, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yeah?
I'm loving this weather.
Good.
Got my shorts on. You know me, I like to wear shorts and flip-flops. That's kind of my thing.
It is.
T-shirts.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a lot of people out walking their dogs. People are happy.
Yeah.
That this weather is turning.
It's nice to get outside.
It is. It is. I think it lifts everybody's spirits. My wife's been doing a lot of kind of power walks on her lunch.
Yeah.
And I can tell it's definitely lifting her spirits.
It's good. It's a good mood enhancer.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt about it. Let's go ahead and give our Patreon shout outs. We had Sarah Allen.
Hey, Sarah.
Ellery.
What's going on, Ellery?
Erica Gallagher.
Hey, Gallagher.
Jasmine Kelly.
Hey, Jasmine.
Tiffany.
That's happening, Tiffany.
Karina Riley.
Hey, Karina.
Isabella Medina.
Hey, Medina.
Funky Cold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Alan Espinoza.
Hey, Espinoza.
Ashley Turner.
Hi, Ashley.
Martin Newman jumped out at the highest level.
What's going on, Newman?
Taylor Ellison.
Hey, Taylor.
Dave Duffy jumped out higher than our highest level.
What's going on, Duffy?
Caitlin Dickert.
Hey, appreciate that, Caitlin.
Teresa Ballou.
Hey, Teresa.
Mara Pierce.
Hey, Mara.
Amanda Nickerson jumped out at her highest level.
Nickerson in the house.
We had Cat Q.
Hey, Cat Q.
Lisa Para Parks.
Well, what's up, Para Parks?
Courtney Dyden jumped out at her highest level.
Hey, Courtney.
Kathleen Berry.
Hey, Kathleen.
Kim Hood.
What's up, Kim?
Jonathan Platt jumped out at her highest level.
Well, thank you, Platt.
And last but not least, Todd Minty.
Hey, Minty.
Minty Fresh. And yes. Then if we go back into the vault, Gibbs. This week, we selected Badger Ferret.
What's up, Ferret?
Longtime supporter. You know, the new support, the continued support, it's all amazing.
It really is. We really appreciate it.
We had some great PayPal donations as well from Jessica Shelton.
Hey, Jessica.
Michelle Burkus.
Hi, Michelle.
Michelle Mies.
What's up, MM?
And Belinda Rivamonte.
Rivamonte.
Fun to say.
It is fun to say.
Gibbs, right now on True Crime All the Time Unsolved. We have an episode out on 4-year-old Gregory Veelman. And this was the subject of a really good documentary on Netflix. It
was, yeah.
Who Killed Little Gregory. And it's a case from France.
Oui, oui.
So, you know, there's a lot of pronunciations to go along.
Oui.
Oui.
Yeah.
I will say, this is a very tough case. I mean, naturally, because you're talking about the murder of a 4-year-old child.
Right.
But also with what the family had to deal with and some of the things that have come out over the years and, you know, where the leads have kind of pointed to.
Right.
Without giving anything away.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting case. So make sure you check that out. Looks like we're going to CrimeCon, Gibbs, as it stands right now.
My bag's still packed from 2020.
Okay, yeah, you just left it packed.
I did. I don't know if I can fit into any of it.
And just bought new clothes.
I just left the same clothes there, man. I'm just hoping I can fit into them by
then. So unless something changes between now and then, Gibbs and I will be at CrimeCon. So anybody that's going, we can't wait to see you. All right, buddy. Are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time?
I'm ready.
We're talking about Margot Freshwater, who as a teen made some questionable choices, as many young people do. You and I talk about it, you know, virtually all the time. How many things did we do as teens where we think, yeah, that should have landed us in jail, or how did we survive that? But Margot's mistakes caused her to be charged with murder. And after her accomplice was declared unfit to stand trial, Margot was sentenced to 99 years in prison, but she escaped and went into hiding for 32 years until she was captured again. So, you know, this is a story about her actions and things that led up to her being convicted of murder. But then you've got 32 years of a woman who essentially creates one, if not multiple, brand new lives and leads them to the fullest. Her new family had no idea who she really was. And I said she led it to the fullest. Margot never committed a single crime that I know of after she escaped from prison. She went on to become a loving wife and grandmother. So I think there will be questions to be asked, right? Was Margot a victim of her circumstances or a willing accomplice who participated in a crime spree that resulted in the deaths of three innocent people? We had a similar question, right, on last week's True Crime All the Time.
We sure did.
Margot Freshwater had a relatively normal childhood. She and her brother Tommy lived in Worthington, a working class neighborhood of Columbus, Ohio. Not very far from us at all.
No, can be there in a very short time.
Or about an hour.
Or that too.
I always like it when you, I thought you were going to give pretty much an exact time, but right. you just went with short time.
I did.
Margot's brother, Tommy, told the Nashville Scene that growing up, he and Margot were best friends. She was his protector. Tommy and Margot enjoyed playing kickball and building forts together. You remember kickball? Is that still a thing?
It is, man.
I loved kickball.
There's some adult kickball leagues.
Oh, I'm in.
Yeah.
Actually not. I'll probably pull a hammy at my age. Yeah. But as a 16, 17 year old, I was damn good at kickball.
It was a lot of fun. I liked it a lot, man.
Now in the winter, they'd flood the street and kind of make their own little ice rink, play a little ice hockey or just skate around.
I never did that.
No, I've actually never heard of anybody flooding a street. I don't think my neighbors would take kindly to it.
Yeah.
If I tried to do that.
Would not be good.
I also read that she played football and was on the track and swim teams in high school. And that one really surprised me. Not that she played football, because I think there have been a lot of girls over the years that have played football to some pretty high level.
Right.
But you know, Worthington is kind of thought of as what I understand, a pretty high level football school.
Yeah.
Now maybe it was different in the 60s. I don't know.
Yeah. They used to have as far as I remember, a pretty strong team.
Yeah. Like state level type teams, I think in a lot of years. But so for her to make that team, it got me kind of thinking, wow, she must've really had some high level athletic ability. Margot also worked as a babysitter. And I think Gibbs, although the siblings were happy, a lot of that they did on their own because they did not live in a stable household. Their mother was an alcoholic and their father abandoned the family when they were both young. And Margot was only a year older than Tommy, but she helped raise him. And it might have been part of that reason why Margot never finished high school. She ended up dropping out, but she also ran away a couple of times, once in 1964 and again in 1966. And she was gone long enough that her family reported her missing. So this wasn't a one day, hey, I came back in 12 hours. right. just to show you how unhappy I am type of deal. In 1966, Margot became pregnant. The father of the baby wasn't interested in helping her raise their child. And you know, Gibbs, probably better than most, the 60s were a much different time.
It was an amazing time, man. I was a little infant in 66.
You were just hitting your mid-30s
yeah.
in the 60s. But it was, especially for unwed mothers. I mean, you know, they were viewed in a much different light and a much more negative light than what women are viewed today.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
You know, a woman who chooses to have a child without a father or without being married, you know, is not going to be publicly shamed in the town square. But in the 50s and 60s, I don't know, maybe that might have happened.
There was a lot of Rumorville back then.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, just negative, looked down upon, that type of thing. Margot met her future boyfriend, Alfred Schlereth, in Columbus in July of 1966. She was 7 months pregnant at the time. Alfred had abandoned his own wife in California. He helped Margot get an apartment, and he was a gambler. That's how he made his money.
Doing some alley craps?
I don't know. Shooting craps, maybe hitting the... playing the ponies, yeah. maybe high stakes poker game, maybe a rounder situation. I don't know.
Maybe he's like the Cincinnati Kid.
Maybe. I always wanted to be one of those guys in rounders.
Did you? Yeah.
But I'm too risk adverse. I'm not as risk adverse as you are, meaning I'm okay opening my wallet to right. purchase things, but I'm not willing to gamble large sums of money. I'm just not.
I'll gamble with your money anytime.
Well, sure you would.
Yeah.
Sure you would. And have.
And have.
And have. And I didn't know until, you know, the bookie came looking for me and I was like, I never placed any bet.
He's Big Mike, not me. Go after him.
After Margot gave birth, Alfred encouraged her to give the baby up for adoption so that if something happened to him, she could get married pretty easily. So this guy was helping her, right? Find a place to live,
yeah.
helping to provide for her, but he was not really stable. He wasn't what you would call a supportive boyfriend. He lost a bunch of money gambling, which a lot of gamblers do.
Kind of goes with the job.
Well, it's not a sure thing, and that's why they call it a gamble.
Right, exactly.
But because of that, he began stealing to earn money and eventually got arrested in Tennessee. So one day Margot told her brother Tommy that she was going to Memphis to help get Alfred out of jail. Now he didn't think that she'd be gone long, but it turned out to be the last time he saw his sister for over 30 years.
That's a long time.
Imagine that you have a very close sibling, which you do.
Yep.
You have a couple and they say, you know what, Mike, I got to run down to Memphis for a day or two, I'll be back.
Right.
You don't see him for 30 plus years. No calls, no, hey, I'm doing good, no nothing.
I'd be like, about bleeping time.
You would not, and I know it.
No.
Margot took a 15-hour bus ride to Tennessee to help Alfred. He was in the Shelby County Jail on armed robbery. While she was in Memphis, Margot began a relationship with her boyfriend's attorney, a guy by the name of Glenn Nash. And according to Alfred, Glenn and Margot originally planned to smuggle guns into the courtroom to free him. He says that was their original plan.
Well, that's a heck of a plan.
Well, and if that's your starting point, then yeah, you got nowhere to go but up from there, I think. But instead of doing that, they must have thought better of it. They ended up having an affair. Glenn was 38 years old, 20 years older than Margot. He was recently divorced. He was an alcoholic, and he struggled with severe mental illness.
But he was an attorney.
He was.
Yeah.
He was, which just goes to show you, right? And we know this, and everybody listening knows this. Mental illness can affect anyone.
Oh, absolutely.
All types of different ages, ethnicities, walks of life, level of education. It doesn't really live by any kind of border like that.
No.
Right? It's a non-discriminatory disease, as are most of them. Unsolved Mysteries described Glenn Nash as a hard-drinking lawyer. And we already mentioned that he was thinking about smuggling guns into the courtroom. So, you know, maybe the guy wasn't on the up and up. He was being investigated by the Memphis Bar Association for misconduct. He also had a criminal history, which I found interesting.
Yeah. How do you get one of those and still practice law?
Yeah. Maybe times were different back then. I don't know. I always thought that it was pretty tough to get your license, or virtually impossible if you had a pretty good criminal record.
Makes me think about that movie with Matt Damon.
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
What's that? Mickey Rourke played that.
The Rainmaker?
Yeah.
Is that the right
one?
Sure
it is. Yeah.
Let's go with that.
Yeah. But Mickey Rourke. He played, I can't remember the guy's name, but he had like a weird name, but
he played the attorney that they were working for.
Kind of shady attorney.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Grisham novel.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what popped into my head too, because I think that's the reason why those guys were having to do certain things, right? Is because Mickey Rourke had a criminal record or something, and he couldn't do... Somebody had a criminal record.
There's something there that kept them from... Yeah.
Maybe it was Danny DeVito, kept him from being an attorney. I can't remember. Glenn and his wife, Gisella, met in Germany while he was in the army. They married in 1950 and moved to Tennessee. Nash got his law degree in Memphis. Then after his father died in 1961, apparently people said his entire personality changed. In January of 66, he was arrested with 9 other men for a robbery of $100,000 worth of money orders. But he was found innocent. In June of that year, he was accused of stealing 3 $10,000 bonds, but was released for lack of evidence. In November, he was fined $50 for contempt of court for failing to show up to represent a client. So, again, I don't know what the extent of his criminal record was. Maybe it wasn't to the point where it affected his law license. Now, if he would have been convicted of any of these things that we talked about, that definitely would have been.
I think it'd be hard to practice law if you're a felon.
Yeah, well, and especially when you're convicted of a crime that has to do with the theft of money, right? The fiduciary responsibility. You can't be a lawyer.
No.
At that point. During their marriage, Gisella said that he often disappeared on the weekends. She had no idea where he went, and eventually they... you know, couldn't reconcile their differences and got divorced by the end of 1966. So it seems like, you know, within the matter of about 5 years or so after his father dying, he really spiraled downhill because Glenn started having delusions. He believed that the bar was conspiring against him, and maybe they were, you know, if some of the things that were said about him are true.
Sure.
It could have very well been a fact that they were trying to get him disbarred or working behind the scenes to see what they could do.
He's not good for our profession, guys. We got to get him out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, his alcoholism did not help with these delusions. And then you had Margot, who came to his office to ask for help in getting her boyfriend out of jail. She had no money to pay him. She didn't even have money for a place to stay while she was in Memphis. You know, she got the bus ride down there and it was like, okay, what do I do now?
Yeah.
I know I need to get Alfred out of jail, but I don't have anything to my name.
How am I going to do that?
So Glenn agreed to work Alfred's case pro bono. And on top of that, he paid for Margot to stay at a boarding house. Margot wrote a letter to her mother, and in it she said she was working as a secretary for a Memphis attorney and was planning on coming home for Christmas. And it was around that time that she and Glenn began their relationship, but he's having these delusions, Gibbs, right? The bar's coming after him. Unfortunately, what Margot didn't realize was that she was getting involved with a killer. Glenn was losing his sense of reality. The LA Times reported that his own attorney later described him as, quote, crazy as hell.
That's one description that maybe you don't want.
I think I can definitively say you don't want your attorney describing you as crazy as hell unless your end goal is what?
Well, if you want to go after an insanity defense.
Yeah, exactly. Then you're okay with it because it's strategery at that point.
It is.
On December 6th, 1966, Glenn asked Margot to go with him to a liquor store. He told her landlady at the boarding house that he was taking her out bowling. Margot reportedly didn't want to go, but she agreed. Around 8 p.m., they arrived at Square D liquor store. Glenn made Margot stay up front at the cash register while he took the clerk to the back room. And a customer actually entered the store. Gibbs and Margot rang him up as if she worked there while she was waiting for Glenn. Glenn tied up the clerk, a man named Hillman Robbins Sr., and he began questioning him. He accused him of being an agent of the Memphis Bar. So I think this speaks directly to his delusion.
Sure, it does.
That he was having. After questioning this guy, Glenn shot him in the head 5 times. The couple stole $616 from the register and escaped in their car. Witnesses saw Margot and Glenn flee the liquor store in a white Ford Fairlane. At 8:47 p.m., a customer came in and found Hillman dying in the back of the store. Hillman Roberts Sr., he was only in his 30s, had a wife and 2 children. He was the father of Hillman Robbins Jr., a one-time amateur golf champion. And I always think about this, Gibbs, in these types of cases, right? Somebody comes to work, something that they've done, you know, how many different times in their life, expecting it to be a normal day, a normal shift. And then all of a sudden, it turns out that they're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And they meet the wrong person.
The wrong person. Yeah. Nightmare. This was a nightmare.
Yeah, for everyone. And I mean everyone, right? Obviously, Robert Hillman Sr., his family, but it's going to turn out to be a nightmare for Glenn and especially Margot as well. On December 18th, witnesses saw Margot and Glenn leaving a Florida mini market. Esther Boyer, the night manager, was dead inside the store. She'd been shot in the neck, and apparently Gibbs, a couple driving past the store, heard Esther scream. They saw her running, and then they heard a gunshot. Inside the store, they saw a man and a woman filling up a grocery cart, and Glenn Nash's fingerprints were later found on the cart.
So that's good. He was in the system from his previous
encounters with the law. But police really weren't able to connect the murders until 3 days later when they found Glenn's car abandoned on a highway in Oakland, Florida. Inside the trunk, they found rope and they found some bullets. And eventually these bullets were matched ballistically to the liquor store murder. They put out an APB after they learned the car was registered to Glenn Nash. And on December 19th, an officer stopped Glenn for questioning, but the witnesses didn't recognize him as the man they saw in the mini market. So police had to let him go. At 10:30 p.m. on Christmas Day, Glenn and Margot were driving when they ran out of gas in front of the home of a man named M.M. Jennings. They were now in Mississippi. They knocked on the door and Margot asked if she could use the phone. Margot called someone to check into getting some gas, but the couple ended up walking to the Rip Van Winkle Motel about 100 yards away to stay the night. The next morning at 8 a.m., they left the hotel. They were standing outside in the rain, and a man named Charles Richardson invited them into his home. You talk about a good Samaritan.
Man.
Now, I get it. It's the 60s.
Right.
You know, it's the decade of love, loving, hate Ashbury, love your fellow neighbor and all that stuff. I just am fast forwarding to 2021. And, okay, if I look out my window and I see a couple standing out in the rain, am I going to willingly invite them into my home?
You? No.
No, I am not.
That's not
and it's
happen.
Not because I'm a mean guy. We've talked about this. I just don't put myself in situations with people that I don't know that could go badly. I try not to.
You would open the door and say, hey, and they think, yeah, we're going to let it, we're going to let us in. You're like, no, you need to get off my yard, off my yard.
You get off of my yard.
Maybe you toss some umbrella.
Maybe, maybe. But I think to me, Gibbs, what's even more bizarre was that Charles left for work and left them inside his home.
Yeah.
He called at about 11:30 a.m. to talk to his maid to check on the couple. And at that point, she said they had called a taxi and they were leaving. So, I mean, it ends up working out for this gentleman.
Right.
But I still think it's a little strange.
I'm sure, though, later he thinks about who he let in his house.
Oh, after he finds out what the, you know, what has happened to a number of people that had run-ins with Glenn and Margo.
Absolutely.
Oh, you bet your ass. All right, Gibbs, let's take a quick break. I want to talk about Buffy. You know, this is one of my favorite companies. My wife can't hardly even sleep without her Buffy. Buffy makes the Earth's comfiest comforters and bedding, all designed to be as soft on the Earth as they are on your bed. The Buffy Breeze, and this is by far my favorite, is 100% eucalyptus inside and out. It's breathable, cool to the touch, and temperature regulating. It's hands down the best comforter I've ever had. It's perfect for hot sleepers and warm climates, naturally resistant to dust, mites, and mold, and it is so super soft. Buffy has a bunch of other customer favorites as well. Super soft sheets. My wife likes the comforter protecting duvet covers, so you can switch up your bed's look with duvet covers that get softer with each wash. Buffy has free shipping and returns. Try for 7 nights at buffy.co. And if you're not in love with your new bedding, they'll take it back and use our code TCAT for $20 off your first purchase of $80 or more. That's code TCATT at buffy.co. And next up is a new sponsor called Firstly. Hey, we all love wine. Who doesn't? But who hasn't been in this situation? You're standing in the wine aisle. You're staring at the shelves. What do you buy? How do you know what to buy? Do you want a California red? Maybe something organic? Or do you just pick the bottle with the nicest label? I know for me, wine shopping can sometimes be very overwhelming. Well, thankfully, there's Firstly, a better way to discover wine at a fraction of the price you'll find in a store. Firstly is a fully customizable wine club that sends curated boxes of wine that are perfect for you. They take all of the guesswork out of it. Each wine shipment is entirely customized to your unique palate and preferences. Firstly uses a one-of-a-kind algorithm and your feedback to curate future wine recommendations. I've only tried one bottle so far, but it was amazing. And I'm really impressed with the flexibility options on their subscriptions. So save time and money and stress with Firstly, the wine club designed with you in mind. Join today and you'll get 6 bottles of wine for $29.95 and free shipping. Just go to tryfirstleaf.com/TCAT. That's 6 bottles of wine for only $29.95 and free shipping at tryfirstleaf.com/TCAT. So a driver named CC Surratt was dispatched to the house. He radioed that he was heading out to pick up his passengers. And it was at that moment that dispatcher Merle McMillan received a phone call from the police chief who asked her if she sent out a driver to pick up a couple. So she tried to get a hold of CC. She radioed him. He answered and told him that he did have a man and a woman in his car, but then he never answered the radio again. And on December 26th at 3 p.m., Surratt was found slumped over his steering wheel with a bullet in his head. He was still alive at that point, but he later died at the hospital. So in a pretty short period of time, a number of people have lost their lives after coming into contact with Glenn Nash and Margot Freshwater.
Yeah, it's not been good.
No, but their murder spree was about to come to an end. Margot flagged down a bakery truck and asked for a ride. The driver, a guy by the name of Robert Thornton, he didn't have a radio at the time. And obviously, Gibbs, he didn't learn until later that he was driving around some wanted criminals, people who were thought to have been murderers. Thornton did think that the two were a little suspicious, but he drove through a truck weigh station and no one arrested the couple there. So I think, you know, he later said at that point, he began to relax a little. He asked Margot if she ran away from home, and she told him yes. Shortly after he dropped them off, Margot and Glenn were arrested in Greenville, Mississippi. You know, by that time, Cece's body had been found, and a witness said that they saw Margot and Glenn fleeing from a taxi and reported them to police, and police were able to finally track them down. Police took them to Hernando, Mississippi. I never heard of Hernando, Mississippi.
Really?
No, but I've not spent a lot of time in Mississippi.
No, you have not. You probably just go right to Biloxi, don't you?
I've never been to Biloxi.
Really?
No. My mom's been there a bunch, man. She loves to go down there gambling.
She likes that casino action.
Yeah, but I have not.
There goes your inheritance.
Exactly. Once they got to Hernando, both Glenn and Margot were charged with murder. Lee Meredith, the arresting officer, gave Glenn some prison pants and took his pants and sent them to DC for testing. Margot wasn't real forthcoming with information. She told police that her name was Sue Ann Morrison. She also refused to give them an address, but she did ask if she could send a letter home to her boyfriend, Alfred.
That was sweet of her.
Sure.
Thinking about Alfred.
Yeah. Cause remember, you know, we were supposed to get him out.
Yeah.
But instead we decided to go on a little adventure where a number of people lost their lives.
And he might not think of you as his girlfriend anymore since you've been sleeping with this guy.
Yeah. He might want to distance himself a little bit, although he's probably still in jail at that point. So he would probably welcome a letter at least. Now Glenn confessed to all the murders, but he was ultimately declared unfit to stand trial. His ex-wife, Gisela, told the authorities that her husband was sick. He shouldn't be in jail. He should be in a hospital. When she found out about his arrest, Gibbs, she hired him a lawyer because she knew that his mental state was declining. And to me, that's interesting, right? You have a couple who gets divorced and the ex-wife still comes to this guy's aid.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you?
Obviously, she still loved him very much.
Yeah, cared about him, wanted to make sure that he was taken care of. Now, we talked about the Bar Association, and they had been investigating Glenn Nash, but he disappeared on December 6th. They had no idea what happened to him. Well, obviously, after he got arrested, they knew why he had been missing. Three states declared Glenn Nash legally insane. In November 1967, he was committed to a mental hospital, but he eventually earned his freedom in 1983. He returned to live in West Memphis for the rest of his life. And I really couldn't find much on him, but if he's still alive today, he would be in his 90s.
Yeah. Maybe if he is still alive, he's hanging out with Elvis.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You're going with the theory that Elvis is still alive.
Well, he works at a Walmart.
Oh, and you know that. You have that on good authority.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got you.
Works back in the sporting goods section.
And why wouldn't he? Elvis loved guns.
Yeah.
Loved them.
He did. He used to shoot his TVs out.
He did. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Now, only Glenn Nash was indicted for the Florida murders, but Margot was indicted for both the Tennessee and Mississippi murders. She was tried in Mississippi, but was not convicted. The jury failed twice to reach a verdict. So she then went on trial for murder in Tennessee. That trial began on June 17th, 1968. Her defense attorney was a guy by the name of Robert Ritchie. According to the Nashville Scene, Ritchie described her as a deeply troubled teen with an unfortunate attraction to no good men. I do think that's pretty accurate. It's also kind of harsh, but I do think it's accurate. You could also make the argument, Gibbs, that it's calculated. This description is calculated to paint her as a person who, okay, doesn't make the best decisions, doesn't always go after the best men, but she's no killer.
Right.
Right. No good men, meaning he's the one that killed everybody. She just happened to be along with him.
So don't blame her.
The prosecution argued that even though Margot didn't pull the trigger, she was a willing accomplice who continued her relationship even after she knew that Glenn Nash was a killer. And the prosecution characterized them as Bonnie and Clyde. Right? This came up in last week's episode too.
Sure did, yeah.
We were talking about Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate. You know, those questions kind of linger. Was that a Bonnie and Clyde situation where she was more than a willing participant?
Yeah.
Or was she just along for the ride against her will? In Margot's case, witnesses testified in court that she had opportunities to flee. Apparently, there was a 30-minute window where she was alone in a department store while Glenn Nash was outside. Margot also admitted that she and Nash had sex after he killed Hillman Robbins, but she said she was coerced into doing so. Margot testified in her own defense and told the court that Glenn threatened to kill her if she reported him to the police or tried to escape.
Well, he put fear into her, according to her.
Yes.
And that's kind of like last week too, right? Because Carol would say, he's got my family.
Yes.
And he'll hurt him if I don't go along with all this.
Because I think some of those same questions came up. You know, why didn't you find a chance to run away? Why didn't you leave him somewhere along the trip? In the spring of 1969, a Memphis jury found Margot guilty of first-degree murder. Now, her jury was made up of all men.
Probably seems a little rough in today's standard.
It does, and I think a lot of people have made the argument that, okay, you probably had a little or quite a bit of prejudice there. All men against this woman who they most likely viewed as a killer. At just 21 years old, she was sentenced to 99 years in prison for her crimes. Margot appealed, but was denied a retrial or a new sentence.
That's a long time, buddy.
99 years?
Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah. About as long as you can get.
Yeah. That's like just saying life. Just say life.
Well, yeah. Either just say life with parole if there's a parole date. 99 years is life. But Margot wouldn't be in prison long. The next year, on October 4th, 1970, Margot and another inmate escaped from the Tennessee Prison for Women. An unarmed guard was escorting her and a group of inmates outside. Tommy Lewis from the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations told the show Unsolved Mysteries, the guard had to make a decision whether to stay with the main group or chase after these two. And basically all the guard could do was try to summon some help and have somebody else go after them. And these two women managed to outrun everyone. They climbed a barbed wire fence and, you know, backup arrived too late and they escaped.
I think some of these guards were probably not hard to outrun.
What are you saying? They might've been portly?
Just a little bit.
Maybe.
Just a little bit.
Maybe. I don't know. Now, her friend was caught in the early 70s, so she wasn't out that long. She was caught in Chicago, but Margot made her way back to Ohio, and it's there that she began a new life. But first, she went to Baltimore, and that's where she and her companion separated, and she ultimately took a train to Ohio, because you have to separate.
Yeah, you can't stay together.
No. If you've seen The Fugitive, you know, everybody knows that.
Exactly. Go your separate ways.
And after Margot escaped, She lived a normal life in the suburbs of Ohio. Gibbs, over a period of 32 years, Margot became a wife, a mother, and eventually a grandmother. She never committed another crime, as far as we know. I think she had some parking tickets, maybe some traffic violations, but who hasn't?
I know I have a whole drawer full of violations.
And I keep telling you, ultimately, you should pay those. It's going to catch up with you.
I'm using the whole COVID thing. Sorry, I'd like to pay these, but COVID's keeping me from coming into the...
I imagine there's lots of people using COVID as an excuse for not doing certain things.
Yeah.
Some valid, some not so valid. Margot lived in Mansfield, Marion, Galleon, and eventually came back to Columbus, Ohio. So it seems to me, Gibbs, she went a little bit north.
Yeah.
For a while, hung out, and then made her way back to her hometown of Columbus. That seems a little strange, because if you were on the run, wouldn't you want to go somewhere you've never been? Somewhere where the chance of you running into anyone,
right,
that you ever knew was pretty much slim to none. Well, that chance kind of goes up exponentially if you go back to your hometown.
Yeah, I would have went back there. I would have like went to like South Dakota or something.
So that's even more amazing that she was able to do this for 32 years.
Yeah.
Part of it was because in the early 70s, Margot was able to purchase a new social security number. It's kind of key. Right? You need to take on someone else's identity. She took on the identity of a woman named Tanya Myers. So she's got a new name. She's got a new social security number. She would put fake high schools on job applications. She also managed to avoid having her fingerprint taken for 32 years.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. Now, obviously, we're talking about technology-wise, a much different time. I think nowadays, it would be much tougher.
Yeah.
To get away with this type of thing. Not impossible. People steal other people's identities all the time.
I'm always being fingerprinted.
Yeah, sometimes for very unsavory reasons. I feel bad.
I don't know why they always want to do it.
Well, stop doing the things that you're doing that cause them to want to fingerprint you.
Oh, yeah. There's that.
That's the answer.
Yeah.
At first, Margot worked as a waitress. I mean, keep in mind, she was only 22 years old around this time. She ended up getting pregnant again. She gave birth to her son, Phil. And I said she worked as a waitress, right? There are some jobs that you would, I would think, Gibbs, have to kind of stay away from. Now, I don't know about 1970, but I know jobs like teacher. I think even a school bus driver, they're going to take your fingerprints.
Sure they are.
They're going to run your records and they're going to do this and that. They probably didn't do it in the 70s, but I'm sure there were some jobs that did. And so you would have to have stayed away from those types of jobs. Waitress was not going to be one of them.
No.
Not going to be fingerprinted and subjected to probably a real heavy background screening.
Unless you're waiting tables at the Pentagon lunchroom.
Good thinking.
Yeah.
One to stay away from. Margot eventually married a man named Joseph Hudkins, had two more children, and eventually got her license to sell insurance. She and her husband drove his tractor trailer across the country. She went to go sightseeing. She lived in Marion, Ohio with Joseph Hudkins from sometime in the 70s to about 1988 when he passed away. In Marion, she was a secretary at a plastics company. She also worked at JCPenney. After her husband's death, Margot moved to Columbus. She worked at MetLife and got remarried. She had a daughter named Angie with her new husband. I mean, she is really living life.
Yeah,
so the full insurance. Yeah. Having children, getting remarried. I mean, I think you have to be pretty confident in your backstory that you're going to be able to sell it to these people. And obviously, and you and I have talked about this before, not for a long time, but the screening process to get certain jobs back in, you know, the '70s, even into the '80s, definitely was not what it is today.
No, no. And at this point, she's almost more Tanya than she is Margot.
Yeah. At a certain point, she's going to surpass the number of years that she was Margot Freshwater. You know, if you think about it, she would have been Tanya at some point longer than Margot. And she has the identification to back her up. And I would think it would become easier and easier as you build a history as this person, right? You worked at this place. You did that. And they knew you there as Tanya.
Right.
Let's say. Okay, so your next employer, hey, call my old place of employment. They'll verify. And they will. You're now Tanya. Margot avoided her relatives. And this is something we talked about, right? Why would you go back to Columbus? She had relatives that still lived there. They knew who she really was and would have been able to blow her cover quite easily. She never made contact with her family. She didn't make contact with old friends. In 1984, her siblings declared her legally dead. And apparently she saw her aunt once at a flea market, but said later that her aunt didn't even recognize her. She also ran into a nurse that she knew from high school, but again, this woman didn't recognize her either. And I get that. You know, people change quite a bit over the years. And depending on how well you knew them, if you hadn't seen someone in, what, let's say 15, 20 years, would you immediately recognize them? Maybe not.
You might say, you know what? That person looks familiar. I don't know how I know them though.
Right. Cause you haven't seen now, if you saw them at a reunion every 5 years, okay, maybe you do in 20 years still recognize them. They've changed, but you've seen some of those changes throughout the years. This is a little different situation.
And more importantly, really, when you're at 18, you're going to look a whole lot different later in life than you would if it was like, well, I remember seeing you when you were 30, now you're 50.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah.
Yeah, except for me. I look exactly like I did when I was 18.
You know, you're getting younger by the year.
I got a Benjamin Button thing going on.
You do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting.
All right, Gibbs, let's take our last break and talk about Best Fiends. You've heard me say it before. I have a number of guilty pleasures. I watch the latest Netflix true crime series. I like Xbox games. Sometimes I feel guilty when I'm doing those things that I'm not getting my work done. But you know what I don't feel guilty about is how much I love playing Best Fiends. Best Fiends gives me an endless source of fun that I can access anytime right on my phone. Best Fiends is a match 3 puzzle game like none other, with literally thousands of levels and new content added all the time. You've heard me talk about this for a long time now, and I'm still obsessed with it. And I think that speaks volumes because it means it doesn't get old. I still get excited when I hit that next level, and then that pushes me on to want to hit the level after that. With Best Fiends, there's something new today and tomorrow and every day after that. There's literally thousands of levels to play and counting. Plus, they have tons of cute characters to collect. So if you never get tired of solving puzzles, well, good news. With Best Fiends, the fun never ends. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. You know, springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at SimpliSafe Home Security, the only home security system I use and recommend. Springtime also means more time outside and away from home. And I trust SimpliSafe. I love the myriad of features that they offer. And I love the price. SimpliSafe was named Best Home Security Systems for 2024 by U.S. News & World Report. The system blankets your whole home in protection. There are so many sensors, from detecting break-ins, fires, floods, and more. Plus, they have a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than $1 a day, so you get fast emergency response and dispatch when you need it most. There's no contract, and they have a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you can try SimpliSafe risk-free. Don't absolutely love it? Send the system back for a full refund. SimpliSafe has given Gibby and I and many of our listeners real peace of mind. We want you to have it too. Get 20% off any new SimpliSafe system when you sign up for Fast Protect monitoring. Just visit simplisafe.com/TCAT. That's simplisafe.com/TCATT. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. After police were unable to find her for a number of years, they began to theorize that she had adopted a false identity and was in hiding, but they had no idea how close she really was. And I think it goes back to how many people would have thought that even Ohio, let alone Columbus, would be the place where she would be hiding out. They probably didn't even check that hard. Because they thought no one in their right mind would choose to go back to where they, you know, had lived.
Exactly. Like, nah, we don't even search there. There's no way she would go back there.
On May 5th, 1993, she was put on the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation's original most wanted list. She was the only woman in the top 10. She was on America's Most Wanted in 1994. Agent Greg Costas from the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation was assigned to her cold case. The FBI managed to track her to Baltimore after she escaped prison, but they lost the trail from there. The only lead they had was from her fellow fugitive. She revealed in 1971 that Margot used the alias Tanya. The show producers for America's Most Wanted asked Ohio law enforcement for information on Margot's background. They reopened her file to research her, and Agent Costas went to interview Alfred Schlereth in 1994. He also interviewed her brother Tommy, some other family members, and some of her old friends. He located the father of the baby that Margot gave up for adoption in 1966 and searched phone records. He had a court order to monitor the family's mail, but nothing came from any of these leads. And after America's Most Wanted premiered, viewers called in and said they'd seen her in grocery stores and parking lots all over America. And I think this has to happen.
Oh, yeah.
And it has, because we know we've talked about it, especially on a number of unsolved cases. So many leads come in, the majority of them, I think police know, can't possibly be true. You know, they put fugitives or, you know, missing persons all over the country at essentially the same exact time period,
right?
Which can't be true.
Yeah. I think they look for that cluster of where the majority of the sightings occurred.
But Costas did have two pretty good leads, a woman named Freshwater who married a man with the last name Margot, and a woman from Canada who sent a letter to Margot's half-brother. But neither of these women turned out to be Margot Freshwater. And by 1995, the case was cold again. From 2000 to 2002, Margot lived in an apartment with her new husband, Daryl McCarter. Gibbs, the apartment was just 12 miles away from her childhood home. So number one, that's kind of ballsy.
Really is.
I think.
Yeah.
And number two, Margot Freshwater has no problem meeting eligible bachelors.
No.
She seemed to be very good at that.
She is.
Daryl met Tanya through a telephone dating service. On their first date, they went to McDonald's.
That's a heck of a first date.
It should be everybody's first date.
Set the expectations right there. I'm going to get you a Big Mac and you're going to like it.
I know that's how you roll. There's not going to be any surf and turf on the first day because that's just setting the bar way too high.
And we're going to split that Big Mac right down the middle.
And we're going Dutch. On the second date, they went ballroom dancing.
Which I know you love.
Oh, yeah. I actually took ballroom dancing.
I believe that. I forget.
I'm not ashamed to admit it at all. Yeah. I loved it.
You probably still have your little dance shoes.
I'd go on Dancing with the Stars if they'd asked me. I'm not a star, but I'd go on.
I don't think they're going to come knocking anytime
soon. I don't think they will. I don't think they have any clue who I am. But within a few months of meeting, they got married. At this point, they were both in their 50s. It was Daryl's second marriage and Tanya's third. He was a truck driver. She was an insurance agent at the time. They enjoyed bowling, horseback riding, and road tripping in Daryl's truck. She had her own CB handle, Gibbs. It was Sexy Legs.
Very similar to yours.
Yeah, very similar. I can't disclose what mine actually is, but
yeah,
it's not all that far off. But they drove all over the country. And, you know, it was reported that Margo received a couple of tickets for speeding, but the highway patrol never questioned her because technically she had a valid driver's license.
And I guess Sexy Legs.
And Sexy Legs. But what Margo didn't know was that police were hard at work still trying to track her down. I think, you know, at this point you have the rise of the internet. And that's really what helped police find her. In 2001, the case was assigned to Agent Greg Elliott from the TBI. Unsolved Mysteries contacted the TBI in 2002 to get information for an update episode. The internet was pretty widespread, you know, by this point, and it had become a useful tool for law enforcement.
They had all those databases out there now.
Yeah, so you didn't have to sit around, you know, thumbing through paper files all the time. You could hit these databases. They began tracking Margot's various aliases, which was the key to capturing her. A computer analyst told Agent Elliott to enter the alias Tanya, followed by Margot's birthday. And that's when they found Tanya Hudkins in Worthington, Ohio. She had the same birthday as Margot Freshwater. At first, they didn't believe that she'd be hiding in plain sight. And I don't think I would have believed it either.
It seems too easy.
Elliot called Agent Costas, who also didn't believe it. He pulled up Tanya's Ohio driver's license and compared it to Margot's mugshot. And the resemblance was there.
Yeah.
They described it as looking at a mother and daughter. Agent Costas subpoenaed Tanya's employee records and found a gap in her history from 1966 to 1970.
There you go.
Yeah, kind of hard to explain that four-year period when she was on the run and in jail. Tanya listed Cleveland as her birthplace, but there was no record of her birth in Cleveland. The high school she listed also didn't exist. They knew that at the very least. Even if Tanya Hudkins was not Margot Freshwater, this woman was hiding something.
They needed to find out what.
So they staked out Tanya's apartment for several days. No one came out. And then I think police learned that she and her husband, Daryl, were on a road trip. On May 18th, 2002, Costas was driving home from work and decided to stop by the apartment. Daryl's truck was in the driveway. He called their house phone and a woman answered. He told her it was a wrong number and hung up. But then he called the DA and he begged for a search warrant. The next morning, May 21st, he and Agent Elliott decided to follow her around town. And Margot was captured later that day. The morning of her arrest, she ate breakfast with her family at Jolly Pirate Donuts.
I remember those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about that? Now, she didn't realize that she was being followed by Costas and Elliot, but why would she even think? She had gotten away with this for a very long time.
It's been 30-some years.
I don't even know if by that point you're even looking over your shoulder anymore.
I think you're pretty confident.
I think so. They followed her to a car wash and a grocery store. And I guess this Elliot guy, he even entered the grocery store and he spoke to her about fabric softeners. Of course, she has no idea who this guy is.
No.
And the stakeout team followed her back to her apartment. The DA finally issued the search warrant after comparing the mugshot and driver's license photos. Margot was headed to the athletic club with her family to go for a swim, but the agents panicked. They thought that she was heading to the nearby airport. Most likely, their thinking was, okay, she spotted us. She figured it out.
She's on to it.
And she's going to run. So they made a plan to intercept her. And it was outside the athletic club with her family that plainclothes agents surrounded her and arrested her. She was with her husband, her youngest son, his fiance and her grandson. A little strange to have a whole group bum rush you and arrest your grandma.
It would be Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
What is going on here, grandma? I'm sure Daryl was like, what are you doing to my wife?
Yeah, because, you know, these people don't know her as anything other than, I'm assuming, a loving, caring wife, mother, grandmother. That's all they know. Have no idea who Margot Freshwater is or what she had done in the past. But they learned the truth about who Tanya was. Daryl later told the LA Times, it was like, we walked out of a movie theater and now we're in the movie. So this team approached her and asked her if she was Tanya McCarter. She nodded. Costas told her, we have reason to believe you're not who you say you are. And I think as any husband would do, Daryl stepped up and he said, what are you talking about? This is my wife. Her son, Timothy, said, hey, this is my mom. And the agents told him she was Margot Freshwater. And apparently her son and daughter-in-law laughed. They thought it was some type of scam.
Yeah.
Tanya didn't say a thing. And agents told her she was under arrest. All she asked was to say goodbye to her family. She gave each of them a hug and whispered to each of them, I was afraid this day would come. So pretty much admitting that, up.
Oh, yeah.
It's up. I'm caught.
Had to be a really strange night that night when they all go back home. And sit around the kitchen table. What just happened? Who is mom?
Yeah, all of that. And at some point, the realization's going to hit that a very large part of your life has been a lie. This person that you thought you knew, they're still kind of that person because they did all those things. They raised you. They loved you. But they had a past that you didn't know about, and you're going to have to come to terms with that.
Yeah.
As punishment for her escape, Margot had 1 year added to her 99-year sentence. And let's make it an even 100.
Yeah, we'll just round that baby up.
At the hearing, Margot didn't say a thing. Now, instead of plotting another escape, she began a legal battle to try to get out of prison. And, of course, her family is hoping that she'd be able to get a retrial and she'd be found innocent and freed. At first, her attorney tried to argue that her identity had been mistaken. The fingerprint evidence was challenged. And then Margot completely denied that she was Margot Freshwater and she fought extradition to Tennessee. Eventually, her lawyer changed tactics and argued that Glenn Nash manipulated Margot and threatened her while the prosecution claimed that she was an active participant. Agent Costas interviewed Margot in exchange for letting her say goodbye to her family. She told him that she never lived life looking over her shoulder because to her, Margot Freshwater was dead. She died so Tanya could live. And I think, Gibbs, it became evident that Margot had convinced herself that the events that occurred in 1966 never even happened.
I think you'd have to get that out of your head, right?
Try to. You'd have to try to, for sure. When they asked her why she came back, she told them that Ohio was all she knew. And she added that she only had enough money for the train to get to Ohio. Now, she didn't have an explanation for why she never changed her birthday. And that was a big blunder. Essentially, it was one of the big reasons that she was caught.
Yeah. Wonder how many days she beat herself up over that in prison. If I would just, man, why don't I should just change the year.
Yeah. So 32 years out and they got me over this.
Yeah.
She told her family that she wasn't the same person she was back then. They believed her. They promised to stand by her. They raised money for her defense. They handed out flyers saying a loving grandmother, mother, and wife in Columbus, Ohio needs your help. While Margot was in prison, her youngest son, Tim, visited her. At the time, he was 22 years old. And Gibbs, he had gone his entire life not knowing this dark secret that his mother was hiding. I mean, hell, none of them knew it.
Oh.
Margot's neighbors had no idea that they lived next to an escaped felon. Her family wasn't angry with her at all. I think, Gibbs, they were angry at the police because they felt that it was the police who had ruined their lives. They also believed that she was a victim of Glenn Nash. And I think this goes back to what I said earlier, right? These people didn't know Margot Freshwater. They only knew Tanya, who was a loving wife and mother, cooked their meals, did the laundry, showed up to their baseball games. She reunited with her brother, Tommy, in November 2002. And I think all along, the authorities thought that she and Tommy had met or had some type of contact while she was on the run.
But that's not true.
It's not. Tommy claims the last time he saw her was 36 years before they reunited, when they were both teenagers living in Columbus.
I've been like, hey, sis, that's a really long couple days. I'll see you in a couple days. 36 years later.
It's like the guy who tells his family he's going out for cigarettes and never comes back ever.
Yeah.
And Margot backed that up. You know, she said that she moved back to Columbus, you know, about 2 weeks after she escaped from prison, but she never contacted her brothers or her aunt. Tommy told the Nashville Scene, I saw the little girl, and then I saw the hurt and the pain. She lost a whole family, but I guess she gained a new one too. He was initially upset to find out his sister had been captured, but also relieved that she was alive.
Yeah, I think you've been wondering for 36 years, is my sister dead somewhere? What happened to my sister? Where is she at? What's going on with her?
Or, let's not forget, they had her legally declared dead in 1984.
True. Yep.
So, living with that kind of grief and heartache, that thinking your sister was dead, and then finding out she's alive, but, oh, now she's got to go back to prison.
Right.
Margot petitioned for a retrial. Her defense claimed that the authorities got a statement from an informant that proved she was innocent. And in 2006, the hearings for the retrial began. Margot was unable to attend her hearing due to a heart condition. The jailhouse foreman had died, and there were no records that Glenn Nash confessed to him that he was the only shooter in all of the murders. Now, her attorney argued that this would have been much more useful evidence, obviously, and the verdict would have been different if the defense would have known about it back in 1969. And her defense team argued that the real criminal, Glenn Nash, was free while Margot was in prison. But the judge didn't buy it. He said that Margot had aided and abetted the crimes and used the money from the robberies. Margot was eventually granted a retrial, but she ultimately decided to go with a plea deal. On October 28, 2011, Margot pled guilty to aiding and abetting. She entered what's called a best interest plea, which set aside the first degree murder conviction, gave her credit for time served, and still allowed her to maintain her innocence. So it sounds somewhat similar to an Alford plea,
sure does,
which we've talked about. I'm not as familiar with this best interest plea. It's kind of interesting. The prosecution wasn't happy. They protested the plea deal, arguing that it was unfair that Margot got to live her life all of these years on the lam while her victims didn't. The DA argued that, no doubt in his mind, Margot was guilty. But since most of the witnesses were deceased, all they had were trial transcripts back from the late 60s, which were not going to have the same impact as live witnesses on the stand.
Oh, no doubt. Just not going to have the impact you're going to get if you have a witness up there telling you what happened.
Yeah, there's no way that just reading a trial transcript is going to convey the same emotion, right? As a witness would, saying they were fearful, this is what they saw, and all that. Margot was officially freed from prison on November 1st, 2011. She was 63 years old. She had only been married for 18 months, you know, in this latest marriage, when she was arrested in May 2002. And she was ready to restart her marriage to Daryl. Although she pled guilty, Margot has always maintained her innocence. According to the Columbus Dispatch, Her attorney stated the true measure of her character was evidenced by her new life after she escaped. TBI agent Tommy Lewis investigated Margot for 5 years, but he stated that her behavior during her time on the run does reflect her true character. He also thought that she had been psychologically conditioned to believe she couldn't escape from Glenn. Daryl McCarter was happy to bring his wife home. In total, she spent 12 and a half years in prison. And I think, like everyone who does, you know, some extensive time, she had a lot of trouble adjusting to freedom. You know, when all of a sudden, Gibbs, you can go outside whenever you want, that's hard for some people.
Really tough.
Especially when you've been used to, you know, a system that tells you what to do and when to do it. Realizing that you can just get up anytime you want to and go to the kitchen to get a snack might take a while.
A little bit. Yeah.
I was watching that documentary, The Innocent Man, and, you know, one of the victim's family members became a death penalty rights advocate in Oklahoma. And there, she was interviewing a man who had been in prison for, I want to say 20, 30 years, but it was found out that he was wrongfully convicted. And he was talking about going to a restaurant, and he said the menu was just too big. For 20, 30 years, he had been told what to eat
right
at every meal. Now he's got this big menu and he can't decide.
Yeah.
So what he would do is he would just listen to what everybody else ordered, and he would just say, I'll have that.
Yeah. Just pick from one of those.
And I mean, it was incredibly powerful. It was sad that, because he was wrongfully convicted.
Sure.
And a DNA later proved it. But I think it does speak to, you know, how conditioned you get being in the prison system and how hard it is for people after they get out.
Hey, no doubt. I mean, you think about even just in the movie, Shawshank, right? When he's at the grocery store bagging groceries.
Yeah.
Raising his hand and asking if he can use the bathroom. You know? The
guy says, you don't have to ask me every time.
Yeah, but that's what he's conditioned to. Sure. That's what he expects that he has to do.
When you have virtually zero freedom, and then all of a sudden you have almost unlimited freedom, it's such a stark contrast that it is going to take a while to get used to it.
I mean, it was like all those years I had that wooden chair here, and to leave here, be able to sit in a soft chair. I was like, where's my wooden chair? Because I feel like I shouldn't be sitting in this soft chair when I was at my day job.
Are you comparing this studio to a prison? Because that is wrong and slanderous. 2011 was the last time we could find that Margot was in the news. Gibbs, I assume she's trying to move forward, continue her life. You know, I believe her family has forgiven her for lying, and they're just happy to have her back home.
And I'm sure she is just as happy.
I'm sure she is. And I'll also bet that she'll probably just live in Ohio until the day she dies. But I thought it was an interesting case. And yet it had some similarities to the case that we did just last week, because I do think at the end of the day, you know, you have to make that determination. Everybody does. What kind of hold did Glenn Nash have on Margot?
Right.
Was it a situation where she was fearful and felt as though she had to go along with him, or maybe he would hurt her, or did she just kind of go along with him and, you know, he killed these individuals, but she spent the money right along with him?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that. I think there's really only a couple of people that can truly know what that answer is. But I will say, you know, spending 32 years on the outside and essentially being a model human being, I think that tells you something about what her true deep down, pull all the layers away, you know, bottom line personality is. Doesn't mean she didn't do something wrong in 1966. It doesn't mean that at all, but it definitely means that she can be a contributing member of society. Yeah, I wouldn't put her in the same category, obviously, as some other killers that we talk about, both male and female, who, to my way of thinking, should never be let out, ever. Some of these individuals that you and I profile, because there's really little doubt in my mind that the minute they're out, the wheels would start in their head of trying to figure out who they could kill next. I truly believe that.
I'm right there with you.
That's it, Gibbs, for our episode on Margot Freshwater. A little different. I enjoyed it. I thought it was interesting to research and, see how a woman could escape and essentially outwit the cops for 32 years.
That's a long time.
It is a long time. Now, they caught her and she did time. She didn't do 99 years, but I think you can see why.
Yeah, at the end of the day, her escaping was the best thing she could have done.
It worked out in her favor.
Sure did.
Now, could you make the argument that 99 would have paroled her in X number of years? Yes.
Sure you could have.
But what's that number?
Right.
Is it 20, 25? Most likely she would have done more time in prison, I think, if she had not escaped. We got some voicemails. You want to check those out?
Always want to hear those.
Hi, my name is Janae Johnson from Utah, and I just want to say how much I love your podcast. I don't know if this is strange or not, but I did listen to True Crime Unsolved for a long time. I've been a TCAT listener for years and years, and since pretty much when you started, but I can't listen to Unsolved much anymore because it makes me uncomfortable when they're not solved. So I like to just listen to the TCAT because it's actually solved. And I've turned this on to some of my kids. They're all gone and out of the house. And they have called me and let me know how much they like the show. So I'm pretty excited about that. And I just want to let you know that I am neither Team Gibby or Team Mike. I love you both. And keep your own time ticking. Thank you.
Well, hey, we're Team U.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really cool. Anytime a parent and a child can bond over something. Because, I mean, for me, I struggle with that. You know, finding things that my daughters and I can be into at the same time. Now, my oldest daughter loves true crime, so we will sit and watch the newest documentary, whatever comes out on Netflix or, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
But outside of that, she's into makeup. Okay. Not so much.
Yeah, you quit doing that.
I quit a long time ago.
Sure.
I still do your makeup for your Rex West events, but, you know, those are getting fewer and farther between.
But it is important to, you know, look good.
Yeah. And I like to keep up my skills.
Yeah.
But no, in all seriousness, I think it's very important and I'm sure it's gratifying for her. Okay. The next call, we're going to talk about this and what did you think? And that's interesting.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. My name is Latasha Powers and I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia. We are lovers here. It's very quite nervous calling. I thought that it would have been easy like some other people do, but it's actually kind of nervous. But you know what? I think I got the hang of it. I just wanted to thank you guys for all of your hard work and your dedication. And I've been listening to you guys for about 2 years now. Started listening to you guys when I was working as a housekeeper supervisor, and when I was cleaning my rooms, you guys were like so awesome to listen to. I love you guys' banter all the way to graduating college. So it's been so heartfelt and warming to listen to you guys. As working in the healthcare, dealing with COVID, it does get rough at times, but I don't think you guys understand the magnitude and just the ease of me knowing that there's a podcast coming and hearing you guys speak. So thank you so much all the way from Virginia. And as always, stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
Kind of warms you, doesn't it?
It does.
To hear things like that. I mean, we look at, you know, what people like her are doing and say, that's amazing. you know, frontline people, not just healthcare workers, yeah. which just sounds like she is. You know, I'm talking about people delivering the Grubhub and the DoorDash and people at my local Kroger
yeah.
who are making sure that, and have been for a year, that I can get what I need to live. I mean, all of that's been amazing.
It is. It's so much appreciative.
But then to hear somebody say, okay, well, we're helping keep them going.
Yeah.
It really warms my heart. It really does.
Yep.
Hey, this is Jason, the carpet guy. I called a few years back. I first started listening because of the BTK episode. I'm from the Wichita area, so that case has always interested me. So I started listening to episode 3, 4, and 5. But anyway, I was just calling with kind of an update, which it's not good, and it is April Fool's, but this is not April Fool's joke. Got off the phone with my little brother. He has run into some trouble and with some mental problems, been in and out of prison, but he is in El Dorado where BTK is. He got himself put in the hole, and now he lives directly above BTK. So there's that. But anyway, I just called to let you guys know I love the show. It is my favorite true crime podcast. I listen to probably 50 or 60, but I'm always excited Sunday when True Crime and True Crime All the Time come out. So keep it up, guys. Oh, and I did finally donate. Should have done that forever ago, but I donated on PayPal. So hopefully that helps out a little bit, but keep your own time ticking. Thanks.
Well, it always helps out.
Yeah.
And the donations we get through PayPal and our Patreon folks, it's helped tremendously over the last year. No secret, we haven't had as much advertising as we have had in the few years before, but so it all helps us to keep the ship going.
Wonder if his brother plays toilet telephone with the BTK.
I don't know. Too bad there's not a drain in the middle.
Yeah.
It just kind of flows down onto BTK.
Oh, there you go.
I like that picture.
I think you do. Yeah. I think we all do.
All right, buddy. We had some mailbag. We actually had quite a bit. Our good friend Katie O'Connor sent us in a huge box of goodies.
Oh, thanks, Katie.
Bunch of different types of licorice for you, Duke sausages and coffee for me.
Yeah.
So we love that. Jorge Medrano sent us in a bunch of things as well. Gibbs, he sent some gift cards in for my girls.
Oh, that's awesome.
Starbucks, Chipotle for their work while yeah. you were out.
Yeah.
Reading off the names with me. He sent us some very, very cool, they're serial killer coins, Dahmer, Manson, Gacy. And he got them from like this really cool oddities shop. And I forget the name. I would give a plug for it.
Right.
Some are sending a Harley chip, but also knives for each of us. Mine is a motorcycle knife.
Yeah.
And she pointed out that she sent you a really small knife, and it is a really small pocket knife.
It's tiny.
Because she figured I already have to compete with the K-bar. And so she didn't want to give you any more advantage than what you already have.
I'll still slice you and dice you.
Even though you got me a K-bar for Christmas and I have my own K-bar.
I know.
And you're looking at it. Eyeing it it's from right here. It's closer to me than it is to you.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure I can get to it quicker.
Yeah, we'll see, Jason Bourne. Yeah. All right, we love everyone. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking. I want to tell everybody about a game that I've been playing recently called Two Dots. You know, primarily Two Dots is a puzzle-based game. You have to connect at least two dots of the same color to make a move. And then those connected dots are removed from the game area, and the dots above them drop down until they hit other dots or the floor beneath. But there's a variety of game modes. There's this really cool one called Scavenger Hunt, which is a really relaxing hidden object game. There's different levels to the game that are grouped into worlds, and it's very satisfying to move up. There's over 5,000 unique puzzles and fun levels. And with all the different gameplay modes, it really makes the gaming experience unique and exciting with every single puzzle. The visuals are amazing, and the in-game music I found to be very soothing. You can even challenge your friends on Facebook to make it competitive, link up, and see how your dot skills match up. And best of all, it's free to download. And you don't need Wi-Fi to play it. You can play it offline as well. Think you have what it takes to solve some fun puzzles? Download Two Dots now for free on Android or iOS.